From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made January 19th, the day that the third annual women's marches were held across the United States. While this year's demonstrations were smaller than those of previous years, more than 500,000 people participated at 319 different marches. According to the Washington Post, the day ranked 7th among the 10 largest days of protest since President Trump took office. But this year's events were not without their issues and controversies. Controversy over allegations of, in one case, anti-Semitism among the march's national leadership, discouraging some from attending. Some demonstrations were canceled due to inadequate funding, while others were canceled due to a lack of diversity among the leadership and participants. In New Orleans, leaders canceled their march, deciding to work on diversifying their cohort. And in New Jersey, there were tensions between the Women's March and Black Lives Matter. The fractures within the marches reflect conversations about the need for better understanding of intersectionality and the need for more diversity in our communities. It is one of the themes of this year's Susan B. Anthony Birthday Luncheon. In this hour, we discuss the value of diversity, how to find common bonds with people outside our so-called bubbles, and the state of gender and racial disparities today. First of all, as I take a swig of water, it's been a long week, Deborah Hughes. I have been so sick this week.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, everybody. So can you say hello?
Hello,
Evan. Can you tell us who you are?
Sure, I'm Deborah Hughes. I'm the president and CEO of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Delighted to be here with you.
It's great to have you. Thank you very, very much. And joining us on the line, and I'm going to be just fine, Dr. McLaurin, is Dr. Irma McLaurin, who is the CEO of Irma McLaurin Solutions. She's an anthropologist, an author, and co-chair of the 2018 Seneca Falls Revisited Conference and Retreat, and the keynote speaker at this year's Susan B. Anthony Luncheon. Dr. McLaurin, welcome back to the program. Thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me again, Evan. Great to be back.
It's great to have you. Deborah, I always like to ask you and the leadership of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House, you know, how you sort of decide on who you want to bring in for keynotes, because you bring in such compelling speakers, people with really interesting backgrounds and perspectives. Tell us how you ended up working with Dr. McLaurin for this year.
Sure. One of the things that I really like about what we do at the Anthony Museum is the annual birthday luncheon. We try to bring in speakers, thought leaders of national or international note who can come here to the community and teach us, guide us, confront us on issues, and inspire us as well. We always want to connect that with Susan B. Anthony's causes and what she believed in. And I met Irma last summer. We were co-chairs of the Cruise Conference that was here in Rochester. We were introduced by a mutual friend, Sharon Nelson, and thought Irma would be an ideal speaker for our community and for the Anthony Museum this year.
And so if you want to attend, tell me the details.
Yes, the lunch is February 13th. That's a week from Wednesday, from noon to 1:30 p.m. at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. You can call us to buy a ticket, or you can buy tickets online by going to the website susanb.org.
Two Wednesdays from now.
Correct. February 13th.
All right, Irma, there's so much you could talk about there. What are some of the broad themes you want to bring to Rochester?
Well, I'm always interested, if you've seen from some of my writing, in how we connect, but also to value our differences. And so part of what I'm going to talk about is Susan B. and me. How are we connected, but also how are we different? And how the time span that separates us has sort of changed the dynamics in terms of what she thought was important and what should be forefronted, and then my own experience in terms of what I think is important and what I choose to be an activist around.
I'm looking right now at a blog post you wrote for the American Anthropological Association titled, "Are We So Different?" And in that piece, if you don't mind, I'd like to quote from a couple of sections on it, and you can tell us a little bit more about that, Irma, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Yeah, you're right. When the end comes, our minute genetic differences will be obliterated. We will be reduced to bones, shriveled skin, and eventually dust or the ashes of cremation. And our simple DNA material, our genes, will be tested and processed to determine who we really are. And what will your DNA say about you? Will it show if you lived a life of acceptance and inclusiveness? Will it be able to pinpoint if you spent your short or long life hating? Will it tell a story of someone so enraged by racial myths that they would murder 9 innocent people in church and after praying alongside them? You write, "Are we so different if we both bleed when you cut me? And if Ebola and Zika viruses can infect us regardless of our race or religion? Diseases know no borders. They have no respect for mythic racial classifications, for national origins, or whether you wear a hijab or pray at sunrise and sunset. They are making us all sick and killing us too across such boundaries. Are we so different if we both seek solutions to how to break the cycle of inequality, of racial gaps, of social disparities? In light of the consequences of a racialized, racist system of inequality, we must say yes, we are different, very different, very, very different, but that difference is not in our genes, it is in how we maneuver socially in the world. Me as black, you as white. Whiteness and maleness provide a universal credit card that gives access and unmitigated freedom to power and privilege. It also allows the beneficiaries to abuse their power and privilege in order to maintain this order and keep the structures of inequality in place. Whoever willingly gives up power and privilege. Are we so different? I think not. We are simply two sides of the same coin, entangled in historic and present-day webs of history. We are the sum total of the choices we make to be prejudiced, racist, homophobic, anti-Muslim, or simply inhumane. We are the sum total of the choices we live, to be courageous, to challenge, to not tolerate intolerance, to be anti-racist and humane. Are we so different? I think not. If we cut each other, we both bleed. We are connected through our very human and humane mutuality. So, first of all, Deborah Hughes, had you heard that?
I hadn't heard that. But you can see why we're inviting Dr. McLaurin to be here with us. I knew that Dr. McLaurin was a part of the exhibit, Why Are We So Different, that was at the RMSC, and so I admired her work in that way.
So in so many ways, we are not different, but in some of those ways, as you highlight, we must say we are different. We are very different in how we maneuver in the world. So can you elaborate on some of those themes, Dr. McLaurin?
Yes. I think what drew me to this is that the race exhibit, there's this massive 5,000 square foot exhibit called Race Are We So Different that was developed by the American Association of Anthropologists and was actually built by the Science Museum of Minnesota. And I had the privilege of being a Ford Foundation program officer who saw it move from idea to actually implementation. And over the last decade, that exhibit has circulated around the country, and it has reached almost 1 million people, if not more, mainly in science museums. And the reason that we focused on science museums is because that's where some of these ideas about race as biology has become really entrenched. So there are three points to the exhibit. One was to tell the story of the history of race, which is looked at as an idea, not a reality, but an idea that is relatively new in human, in human history. Two, that human variation is real. That is, there are obvious biological differences, phenotypic differences. Variation exists in the natural world, and it exists in the human world. You have different species of trees, you have seas, you have oceans, you have rivers. There is variation, and that kind of variation is real. But it's not biological in terms of how we've come to think about and constructed race. And finally, the exhibit tells us about the experience of what it means to live as a racialized person in this country, is what we focused on, the United States. So I spent most of my life being a champion of diversity well before that term even existed. And there's a history. I am probably a post-civil rights beneficiary. I was born in 1952. And so I was watching this on television, and I think that changed the nature of things as well, because for the first time on a massive scale, because of the media, people became aware of Jim Crow laws and segregation. I benefited from the opening up of the passage of the civil rights law and white institutions opening up their doors to mainly what were called historically underrepresented groups. We now talk about people of color, but at that time it was very specific. And that civil rights movement led to affirmative action. And the specific groups were groups whose history was rooted in the history of slavery, inequality, and genocide in this country. And that was African Americans, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, Puerto Rican and Chicano, and Alaskan Natives. And so there were very specific groups. Now when we talk about diversity, we're looking at everybody, people whose history is in this country, but also people who come with the history of inequality in their own country. And then that is kind of grafted on to what they then experienced and learned here in the United States.
We're talking to Dr. Irma McLaurin, who is going to be here in Rochester February 13th at the Riverside Convention Center for the 2019 Susan B. Anthony Birthday Luncheon. And you can still attend. You can get tickets at susanbanthonyhouse.org.
Susanb.org. Well, it's a quicker way to get there.
Susanb.org.
There you go.
I should know that. Should be on my list there. SusanBAnthonyHouse.org. February 15th, by the way, would be Susan B. Anthony's 199th birthday. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So a lot to get you ready for here. I want to ask you, Dr. McLaurin, about some of the commentary surrounding those events last month regarding the women's marches. You know, critics jumped on some of the divisions, some of the canceled marches to say, look, this is a movement that's too divided. And there's been some introspection. I think there's been some tough conversations. I want to read a little bit of a piece that Rebecca Traister wrote for The Cut, a piece titled Don't Give Up on the Women's March. Rebecca Traister is a journalist, and writing from the political left, she is one of the consistent voices regarding women's issues and rights in this country. She writes, her newest book is called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. And here's what she wrote about the piece for Don't Give Up on the Women's March. Quote, some state and local leaders have pled with the national co-chairs to step down. Organizers in Chicago and Baton Rouge have announced that they will be canceling events this year, though another group in Northern California that initially announced its cancellation due to participants being overwhelmingly white appears to have simply rescheduled its march. In New York, there will now be competing marches, a scenario that is as boneheaded as it is self-defeating, end quote. And Traister goes on to say that these divisions reflect legitimate concerns that women of color have and should raise, and that white women need to listen to. But her concern is if the entire thing fractures and you end up with competing marches, that especially at this moment of sort of political uncertainty, that there's a real risk going forward on some of these issues. I know these are complex questions. How do you view some of those divisions right now?
Well, first and foremost, they're not new. One of the grants that I gave when I was at the Ford Foundation between 2005 and 2007 was a grant to the National Women's Studies Association. They had had a similar kind of fracturing back in the mid-1980s when black women and other women of color like Audre Lorde and key people walked out and said, we will never come to this organization again. It is racist. It is, you know, it's not hearing us. Our voices aren't heard. And they left en masse. A few stayed behind. In 2006, I went to the National Women's Studies Association and said, if you could be the vision of what everyone says you have the potential to be, what would it take? And they received grants from the Ford Foundation. And one of the things they did was to absolutely commit themselves to building the leadership of women of color as part of their ongoing agenda. As a result of that, in 2009, which was, they had to change when they had their conferences, they had to undergo some other things, but essentially committed to that, and that they would retain that commitment even after the Ford funding was gone. They've kept their promise. They are one of the most transformative organizations. Beginning in 2009, every single president of the organization has been a woman of color. And they continue to hold pre-conference workshops to build women of color leadership. And I think so part of what this is saying is that if we can work together, if we can find ways, and I want to read something that resonates and in some ways has guided me. And this is from Martin Luther King. He says, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. And you have people over time, the colonizer and the colonized by Mimi, who talks about that oppression not just impacts the person who's oppressed, but it impacts the person who is doing the oppression. I think what the person you quoted is saying is that you don't throw out the proverbial baby with the bathwater. There are some issues, I think, for white women who, on the one hand, have experienced inequality around gender dynamics and gender combined with other kinds of sexual orientation, religion, but there is a whiteness privilege that they carry that they're not necessarily conscious of, and that sometimes they're operating out of the lens that they know best for everyone. And I think what women of color are saying is that you need to sometimes step aside. One, you need to be conscious that you may harbor that perspective, and you need to sometimes step aside and let other voices be the lead, be heard, because at the end of the day, we're all implicated in this mess. We're all implicated in forms of oppression. And this is where the concept of intersectionality comes in. It is not about multiple identities. Intersectionality is about understanding that some women, some people, are impacted by more than one form of oppression. So that it can be race and gender and sexual orientation. And that means that, and it can be religion, and that means that that one person is navigating all of these systems and trying to figure out how to survive. If you solve a policy, let's say you create a policy or a set of laws only to deal with race, you've ignored the intersecting way that those other things actually impact that person. So I think what is being said, and I'm sorry that people have moved away to say it, is that let's stay in the fight, but let's, that we have our own internal struggles, that there are some things that people are blinded by. They can't see it, and they need to be able to know that they have blind spots and that we need to work together because there is this mutuality that we're all implicated in.
Deborah, do you have concerns that right now the fractures are, because I think Dr. McLaurin is making a really salient point here. This is not new, but at this moment, it feels very urgent to a lot of people because they're looking ahead to 2020. They're thinking about what it means if the fractures aren't healed or healed enough, whatever that might mean. How do you feel about that?
Well, we have right now elected a Congress that looks more like the American people than we ever had, but it still doesn't look like the American people. So we have this great moment where we were beginning to see more representation and having more voices, having more perspectives come to the table. And I think that the great risk is that some people see an advantage in dividing the movements, splitting so that we don't bring policy and issues to the table, so that it gets back to being identity politics. And identity politics always serves the people in power.
Have you, Deborah, found the organization struggling at all to maintain a lack of partisanship
at the Anthony Museum?
Because it's nonpartisan, right? It's not
correct.
Susan, okay,
and this is it's a good moment to see. Susan B. Anthony felt that if she aligned herself with a particular political party, she'd be aligned with all of their views and their platforms, and she couldn't control that. She really felt that's not the way to advocate for good social policy. When a political party says, "Hey, we could get more votes if we looked." If we said this, if we go that direction, we see that all the time. So that what comes out in the sound bites for a political party to get people to vote for them may not be their intent or their direction at all. So we don't have trouble saying we're not partisan. It frustrates some people who want to affiliate Susan B. Anthony or the museum with one particular place or another. But how to not be political? Susan B. Anthony. She honestly believed that we should be a government of the people, by the people, for the people, and we're not there yet. And we believe that our function as a museum is to continue to push for that reality. And so that we're kind of in the struggle. We're in the midst of that.
All right, listeners, if you want to join the conversation, you can email the program connections@wxxi.org. You can call 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Are you, listeners, do you feel that there is a significant fracture or fractures that are threatening some progress or movements? Do you feel like those fractures are maybe even necessary to recognize and to repair before movements go forward? How do you feel about what we're seeing? You can call the program or you can email us and join the conversation that way. In some ways, Dr. McLaurin, is this natural and necessary to maybe, is the pain of these conversations and confronting these inequalities necessary? And maybe this is the context I ask it. I have a friend who said after the election in 2016, she said, if Hillary Clinton had won, there'd be no women's marches. There would be no urgency the way we see. And for a lot of women of color, not much has changed for us. And then this friend was telling me, we feel like white women has felt like things have changed, but like for women of color, it's been There's been real vulnerability all throughout here. And so I wonder if you feel that there is a necessary either correction or path here, and that some of this pain and reckoning is part of that.
You know, one of the things I think is important to recognize is that we have to teach more history, because I don't know that there are lots of young women, white or black, who know about Susan B. Anthony, or who know about Audie B. Wells, or who know about, you know, Anna Cooper. They may have heard of Harriet Tubman, but do they really know what her journey was and what her story was? She was known to hold a gun to people's head and say, "I will kill you if you get scared and trying to go back." Okay, that's not the small, demure woman that we're sometimes presented with. So part of it is that fracturing, I think, is part of the way that systems operate. So I do systems analysis as an anthropologist. And one of the concepts around systems analysis is that once you resolve one contradiction, new ones will emerge. That is the nature of change. You know, Darwin's theory of evolution, which was really about the natural world, was that in order for evolution to occur, you had to have variation. You had to have difference. You cannot have change with homogeneity. So if we all thought the same, there'd be no need to struggle. The assumption people made was when Obama got into the presidency that suddenly there would be euphoria and a new magical world for black people. It didn't happen. So one individual to put that on them as being responsible for that ignores the fact that he was operating within a structure. And that structure, if all white people disappeared tomorrow, there'd still be racism, because it's a structure that also has to be dismantled. Not just people's beliefs and their behaviors, but the institutional apparatuses through which they are able to manifest that. And I'll give you one last example. Mm-hmm. Today, over 50% of all the people attending college are women. Over 50%. And yet, almost 85% of all university presidents are white men. Now, how is that possible? If we're educating more women, it would stand to reason that there would be more women presidents at these institutions. And so structural inequality has still managed to maintain a majority of men, even though the student body that these institutions are educating are predominantly women. So that shows you that it's not the individuals, but it's systems and structures that we need to pay more attention to and not be into personality conflicts. We must not buy into the language. And this is really important. Buy into the language of identity politics, or, you know, you're just being politically correct. These are phrases that are intentionally used to derail us, to divert our attention, to sort of get us talking about semantics and not substantive kinds of issues. And so we need to not play into that. So when people yell to me, "Oh, reverse, you're just being a racist," I say, stop. Black people cannot be racist, because racism is a system of institutional power that we don't have. Can I have prejudices? Yes. Can I have biases? Of course. I'm human. We all have biases, right? But can I be racist? Impossible. So we have to be careful about how we permit people. You know, the notion of identity politics was one that was sort of elevated to sort of dismiss the conversation. If I say, "Oh, you're just doing identity politics," then I don't have to really listen to what you say, because I've named it, I've put it in a box, and then I can throw it away. So we have to make sure that we don't get sort of confined by these ideas, and to understand social movements. Social movements, as Margaret Mead once says, it takes a small group of people. The fact that we have had so many, I mean, the Women's March was one of the largest. They stopped counting at 4 million, but they say almost 5 million women, and that was just in the United States. It didn't talk about the kinds of movements that were happening around the world in solidarity. That is powerful. And so does it say that we all need to think the same? I hope not. You know, because we need that sort of difference and those conflicts to push us to be better, to think differently, to look at where we've been and where we want to go. And that's how change occurs.
My guest is Dr. Irma McLaurin, who is on the line with us in advance of her appearance in Rochester. as part of the 2019 Susan B. Anthony Birthday Luncheon that the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House is hosting. They do that every year. February 13th this year, that's two Wednesdays from now, at the Riverside Convention Center. And you can get tickets right now if you like. SusanB.org. Is that correct, Deborah?
That's correct.
SusanB.org if you'd like to join that event there. After our only break of the hour, I want to come back and ask Dr. McLaurin about one of her writings titled Humanity's Fate is Not a Pretty Picture. And there's an interesting, well, there's a number of interesting parts to that. There's a question in there that that Irma asked, which is, when is the last time you really talked face-to-face with someone without a device present? And we're going to talk about the ways we connect, the ways we disconnect, the threats of technology, and maybe ways to build bridges instead of tearing them down. So let's get that break. Come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, longtime NBC News anchor and journalist Tom Brokaw recently said that he thinks Latinos need to do a better job of assimilating into American culture. That sparked a backlash. Brokaw apologized. We'll talk about what assimilation does and does not mean. And then second hour, digging into Black history for Black History Month. Join us Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Deborah Hughes wanted to make a brief clarification of a remark you made earlier.
Yeah, I made a remark earlier where I used the phrase identity politics, and I didn't use it in the right context, so I just wanted to clarify. What I meant to say is that it's so easy for people who are in positions of power to see the vulnerabilities and play off groups that are not in positions of power in ways that disassemble and splinter and break up those groups. So one of the things I was one of those people who went to Washington with three buses from Rochester in January of 2017.
Yep.
And for me, the signs and everything, there were so many people there that our group stood still for 4.5 hours behind the stage. We couldn't even move. We didn't get to march because you couldn't march. There were so many people there. And people were so kind and gentle and supportive. There were a couple red hats who walked through the crowd, and people were good about respecting them and helping them get, clearly they were in the wrong place, and letting them get through. So it was hopeful that for some reason there was all this energy that says there's something that's deeply disturbing about what just happened in November, and I'm showing up to make that statement. I think then when we begin to break it down to say about why were you here, and the press saying, well, this is why some people were here and this is why some other people were here, you know, and it becomes a thing where in 2019, I might say, I don't want to go to the Women's March because I'm going to be perceived as aligning myself with anti-Semitism or with racism or with, and then I don't show up. And so then the people in power say, see, there isn't really much to that women's movement. The Me Too thing. They don't really care. They don't get motivated. They're not going to show up. We won.
They're not organized.
Exactly. And that's what I was saying, that in that sense, when people can see those vulnerabilities, and sometimes I think, I want to say women, but I don't think it's women, and I want to say liberals, but I don't think it's liberals, and I want to say progressives, and I don't think it's progressives. But I do think that there are many groups that are activists for social change who want to do that with integrity and are very vulnerable to those kinds of criticisms and hold themselves to a much higher mark in terms of consistency and integrity than do the groups that have the power.
Okay. Dr. McLaurin, you want to add to that? Yeah, please.
Yes, I think that we are accustomed to having a one menu item kind of political or social movement. So if you were doing blackness, you know, people used to ask me, are you black first or a poet? It's like, you know, are you a woman? You know, you're a black woman poet. And I said, I don't live my life in discrete categories. When I walk down the street, you see my womanness and blackness all implicated together. And that's why I go back to King's concept of mutuality. We have to stop thinking whether you're pro-Israel or pro-Palestinian, that is not the whole world. The question is, are there larger issues that we need to be finding alliances around? And I find it very curious that, again, those who are in power, who have control of the media, they get to define for us what's important. They look at what we didn't do as opposed to what we did do. And again, even though the numbers were smaller, the march by women in 2017 was the largest single internal march in the history of the United States of America and probably the world. You don't get 5 million people together, right? All women, okay? And so they keep focusing, well, the numbers were smaller. Well, some people died, some people got tired. You know, there were young people there. I'm still in touch with a young activist that we met at the subway station, and we still stay friends on Instagram, and I support her because she's, you know, and she's learning the history, and she's an activist. They're going to take all kinds, even if only 100 women showed up. It would still be powerful because it meant that the ideas and the concepts were still spreading. And we also have to understand there are different ways to express your support. It is not always by marching.
All right. So here's David emailing the program to say, Evan, I've heard talk of race, gender, religion. What about class? So Dr. McLaurin, how would you address David's point saying he thinks class is missing from this?
Well, I think class has been something that we sometimes use as a proxy for race, but certainly there are poor people, there are poor white people, and one of the ways in which Jim Crow worked in the before 1960s when the Civil Rights Movement came was to try and separate poor working class whites from poor from blacks. And they would say to white working class people, even if you have nothing, because you're white, you're better than that black doctor over there. You're better than that more educated person over there. So even though class exists and these class disparities, the class differences cut across all of us. Some of us experience it different. A white middle class experience is very different from a black middle class experience. And then there's those of us, I come out of a working class family. My father had a second grade education. My mother dropped out of high school. She then went back to night school and graduated the same year I did. So my roots are very much working class. But having gone and gotten a PhD and another terminal degree and worked as a university president and worked as an associate professor in major research one universities, I know I carry privilege now. And so what I focus on is how can I use that privilege? How can I leverage the privilege that I've accumulated in order to advance some of these issues and give people better understandings of it? Does it mean that I've escaped racism and sexism and other kinds of biases because I now have more education, I'm in a different class? Oh, heck no. You know, I still feel it, but I feel it very differently. And I'll give you a clear example. I just finished writing an article called How Racism is Getting Away with Murder. And one of the points made by the two research groups, one in California, one at Duke University, in which they're looking at the high incidence of maternal and infant deaths and premature births among black women. Here is the startling conclusion they reached, that giving birth, there is no safe age for black women to give birth. And in fact, contrary to what we would think, the higher their education and the higher their socioeconomic status, the more they're subjected to racism, and therefore the more they're at risk of actually dying or giving premature birth. And then take a look at Serena Williams as an example. Here's a woman who has the best of everything, lots of money. Is it also because she'd been subjected to all of these events around race and the way that she's treated differently, even though she is considered one of the best tennis players of all time? It doesn't immunize her against racism or sexism or the combination, the way they come together. So racism is in there. But, you know, we have to stop trying to do what I would call sort of this oppression Olympics, like whose oppression is more than mine. And I think for whites, it is important. I actually just had this happen to me where someone says, well, I think the fact that you call yourself a hyphenated American is wrong. And that is great to have your opinion, but how is it that you believe that your idea is better than mine, that you actually have the power to be able to tell me how I should think about my identity? And I think that's where whiteness is something as a mindset. It's not about skin color, you know, it's about a mindset that believes that the white perspective, whether it's you shouldn't speak, you know, English, you shouldn't speak your own language, you need to learn English, you know, all of these ideas that people have are implicated in this notion that if we say it's right, then it's right, and no one can question it. And if there is a problem, it must be you, because it couldn't possibly be me, because you know, I have this white mindset.
All right, so let me turn, Dr. McLaurin, to some of what you've written about how we sort of engage with one another and some of your concerns about that. You wrote a piece about the value, for example, of speaking face-to-face, and I'm just going to kind of quote a couple of the things you say there. You say, in a piece, Humanity's Fate is Not a Pretty Picture, you ask, when is the last time you really talked face-to-face with someone without a device present? And in that same piece, you argue that technology is making us become less human. And you write, in our technologically disconnected global world, we sow the seeds of humankind's own destruction. What brings you to those concerns?
There is a movement among museums called empathy. And I think what technology does, I have witnessed this, and when I've traveled in Europe, it's a little bit different. I observe in Europe where people will have their devices, as soon as their friends come, they put them away and they talk. Here in the United States, you go down the street to Starbucks or any place else where there's Wi-Fi, and people are connected to something. You will have two people sitting at the same table texting each other instead of talking to each other. And what it does is that it distances us from having empathy for people and understanding their true emotions, because a text can only tell you the words on the page. You can't feel that person's pain, which you can hear in their voice when they talk to you. You can't understand the nuances of what they're saying. The words may say one thing, but when you're speaking, the emphasis you put on that word may actually convey something totally different. As a poet and a writer, language is very important to me, and I struggle over words and the meaning of words and what emphasis I put on words. I look at how I break the line. When you read that poem, I intentionally broke the line at certain spaces so that people would pause when they were reading and think about that word at the end or the word at the beginning. So when we don't have that communication, we begin to become disconnected and I think removed and distanced from being able to relate to people in that respect.
Just a brief aside, it is sort of terrifying to read an author's, a poet's poem, knowing that I am not going to put the emphasis where the author probably wants it. So Dr. McLaurin, I tried to do justice to it. But
you did.
But I really take this point here that that there's a real risk of technology. And I think I want to be an optimist. And I want to ask both of our guests, and I'll start with Dr. McLaurin. I want to be the optimist when I hear, you know, some people work in the technological field say, look, we are coming out of the age of the innocence with this. We're coming out of our childhood with this. Humanity got a big new toy, but now we're starting to recognize the harms. We're going to regulate our behavior. A lot of people are pulling back their screen time. They're pulling back their social media time. There's a backlash to sort of mob mentality on Twitter and things like that. I don't know that I fully see that. I don't know. I want to, Dr. McLaurin. Do you?
I would like to see us. I have made a promise in 2019 to text less and talk more. That rather than texting people, I want to hear a voice. I want to be connected to someone. I want someone to know when they're talking to me. I might break down over the phone because I just lost a nephew at the age of 35 to an illness. So one of the things I'm going to do is use my words to write an article about young black men and what's called silent heart attacks. We actually have a high propensity for it, right? What we have to understand, however, ironically, many of the people who are benefiting from technology, particularly those who own it, who own these companies, they don't allow their children to have access to this stuff, okay? Actually, go and start looking at who's giving their kids. They now have shown that if kids have if they're exposed to these screens before the age of two, it can actually sort of minimize or impact the way in which they're learning and processing, right? So there are some real technological and scientific things that people are coming to understand, but it is also about connecting. What is better for you, to get a text that says, I care about you, or for someone to come up and give you a hug?
Well, I don't have it in front of me, but I saw a piece just in the last 24 hours that sort of seeks to explain why a lot of people, particularly young adults, don't answer the phone anymore. So if you call someone, they will not answer it, and they'll say, just text me. Especially don't leave me a voicemail message. Don't leave me a voice. And I've done that. But it feels like there's a real cost to that.
Well, I also think there's a fear. I think that we have not given children the social skills that they need, and so they're uncomfortable with having that because that means you really have to show up. You're exposed. You're vulnerable. And I think that we've not given kids the tools. When kids cry, we give them an iPhone and let them look at something animated instead of trying to understand, well, why are they crying? Do they hurt? Are they scared? Did something happen? We don't know that. We just hand them a device. And then they sort of go off, and so they have a relationship with the device, but they don't necessarily have a relationship with their friends or their families, you know? And I think we have to look at that. Therapists are talking about seeing more millennials, and I don't want to characterize any one group, but they're also showing that they can't cope. They don't have the coping skills. And so if you give them, they can multitask on a device, but when it comes to managing life issues, they can't necessarily manage more than one thing at a time. They get confused, and they're waiting for that parent to helicopter in and fix it, right? Now, converse to that, the older generation, the boomers who I belong to, we're showing that with aging and also with things like dementia and Alzheimer's, that the more people engage, that they have human contact, that they interact, that they're speaking, which requires them to think, that actually slows down the process. They're also showing that loneliness can accelerate, you know, people sort of falling into kind of depression. So human contact, we are a social creatures, okay? We did not evolve to be alone. That became part of sort of the way that things have progressed. But if you look at it, sociality is what triggered us to be who we are today. And when we start taking that away, we're taking away, in some ways, part of our humanity.
Deborah Hughes, do you find any frustration with the way our communication norms have changed?
I do completely. I think as Irma said, the science is pretty clear. You know, one of the things we know is that picking up your device gives you a little jolt of dopamine. So if you're having a difficult conversation and you're trying to wrestle through something and your first response is to numb that out in a quick fix of technology, how do we become deep thinkers? How do we become people who can look at our biases? And I'm deeply disturbed about that. I'm also disturbed about the content that gets into our lives. I've always been an early adopter, and I can go down the technology rabbit hole pretty fast. And often I'm reading information, I'm absorbing information, and then I kind of emerge and go, well, that wasn't even a good thread, that it wasn't even a good direction. And I'm at a loss now sometimes to find good stuff and to immerse myself in good stuff. I know it's out there. It's not on TV. I can't believe how much silly stuff is on TV. Not that TV's always been a great cultural asset, but you know, I learned a lot from watching the early Star Trek. I learned a lot from watching All in the Family, there's still some really good programs out there, and there's some great stuff happening in films and media. But I have trouble finding a really good news show that's going to take me deeper. You know, I want to know I would like to know. So, can we outline what the economic risks or the physical risks are in relation to our southern borders? Why is that not in the news?
Sure.
I see it's a two-part thing. I think we're hungry for information. I think we don't know how to get good information or experiences, and I don't know that's out there.
Well, I recently tweeted that just keep in mind that everyone you meet on social media is nicer in real life. Everyone. Everyone you meet. Everyone you encounter on Twitter, if you were to meet them in person, they would be a nicer person. That's me. That's everybody. And I think there is this temptation, Dr. McLaurin, that we all want to have the zinger or the last word, or we want to sort of signal our moral superiority. You know, we want to show that we have the right views. But it doesn't really create real engagement. I think it. Deborah, you want to jump in there?
Yeah. Well, I kept thinking, as you were talking earlier, about the experience of going to New Orleans to help with some hurricane relief. And one particular time when we were working with a couple, and when we arrived, they were so excited because they've been waiting over a year to have their house worked on. And it turned out that their house needed to be condemned. So here we thought, we're doing good, we're coming, we're doing this wonderful thing, and then we're actually having to tell them, we can't do it, we've totally failed. And the response from them was, no, you haven't, you're here. They said it was the most healing thing that had happened, just that we were there with them.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, certainly the lampooning of you know, sort of this generation of Americans would be, most people would tweet about the need for relief help than actually go and do it. But they would pat themselves on the back for tweeting that they believed in the relief efforts as opposed to participating in them. You know, it's interesting. And Dr. McLaurin, before I ask a couple other questions, just do you want to put a final point on that? Do you see, is this going to be sort of require a cultural shift that we're going to have to create movements that almost very directly and intentionally take screens out of our hands, take screens out of kids' hands? I mean, what's the path forward there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I now require, when I do writing workshops, that people bring a notebook, no computers. I said, because the data, the research is showing that you actually retain more if you use a pen and paper than if you sit and type up all your notes. So that's one piece. I've been reading about professors who teach technology who say that the lights and the screens are distracting, and so they only allow students to come into a class in which they're teaching about IT to come in with their devices when they absolutely are going to use them. So we're getting more data. The other thing is that we're so reliant on what is in, we've lost libraries. They now just give us electronic books, you know. So they're disappearing. And when I walk into a real bookstore, you know, I was just in Amherst, Massachusetts, and like the old bookstore is still here. And just to go in and just pick up a real book is such a satisfying thing, right? I can flip through it as opposed to unscreen because you're hurting your eyes. But one of the things that happens is that we have to understand that some of the information, like Google, has become like Xerox. It's a brand name that has become a proxy for the process of looking up and researching. But there's a group in California who has been researching the coding that goes into those search engines. That is done by humans who bring with it their bias. And I'll give you a clear example. It's not so prevalent now, but it was 5 years ago. If you Googled beauty, all the images that would come up were white women. Now you might find an Asian woman, right, or someone who's mixed. If you Googled black beauty, the only images that came up were horses. Now, the search engine itself, the algorithm, didn't do that. Someone coded that. So there is biases even in the coding. So what we think we're getting, this massive amount of information, it gives the appearance of neutrality when, in fact, it can be heavily biased, and people need to recognize that. So going to the library, you know, I was going through some grief, and I just thought, I just want to read a book. And so I picked up a book about a woman's memoir about her husband and him going through this fatal illness and how she's recovering. And there was something that was just very satisfying about reading that in a book, holding it. You know, then, and I could close it, and then I could sit there and sort of sit with it and let my tears flow and then open it up again. And that's a very different response than sitting and watching and flipping, sliding, you know, a computer screen, slide left, roll up, you know. It's just a very different experience.
Well, before we lose the hour, a couple more questions for our guests here. Jillian in Geneseo just writes in and says, just checked out tickets online and wants to know, is there any way to encourage people of lower income to be part of it? Just looking at ticket prices. Deborah?
Yeah, the reality is it's a fundraiser. We do have some opportunities for scholarships if people wanted to email for that. That's a possibility.
Okay, what's the best way to do that? How do they get in touch with you?
They could email me, Deborah.Hughes@SusanBAnthonyHouse.org.
All right, Deborah.Hughes@SusanBAnthonyHouse.org. Tickets are available for the event, which is coming up, the Susan B. Anthony Birthday Luncheon, their annual fundraiser. And Dr. Irma McLaurin, who's been our guest for the hour, will be there for that with the theme E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. That is two Wednesdays from now at the Riverside Convention Center starting at noon.
Correct.
Starting at noon, and SusanB.org is the website if you want to get tickets there. What are you most looking forward to, Deborah Hughes?
I'm looking forward to being in the room with Irma McLaren and 900 other people.
But, yay!
900 other people. And Irma, before we let you go now, when you travel, when you get a chance to engage with audiences like this, and you know that some members of the audience may have, different perspectives. For some people in the audience, they want to feel united. They want to feel that solidarity. But some of these events are hard. What's the message that you would leave with listeners and with people who may see you on February 13th about, the challenge of understanding that if things feel like they're difficult, that doesn't mean that, there isn't sort of a path forward, a common humanity?
Well, it's a very cliche saying, but no pain, no gain. Even in relationships, if I hear someone say to me, well, we never argue, then I'm thinking there's something wrong, because conflict is a natural part of who we are as humans, right? It pushes us to think differently. It pushes us to examine ourselves. It pushes us, to sort of try and see things from different perspectives. And without that push, we don't grow. We just kind of sit static. And so homogeneity, everything being hunky-dory, is not to me the solution. I tell people, I teach leadership, and I coach, and I say, it's very easy to be a leader when there is no problem. Anybody can do that. That's not, that's simple.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time for us this hour, Dr. McLaren, and we will see you in Rochester on February 13th at the Riverside Convention Center.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
That's Dr. Irma McLaren, who is, as she mentioned, an author, a poet at heart, and an actual poet, an anthropologist. She was co-chair of the 2018 Seneca Falls Revisited Conference and Retreat, and she will be there at the Riverside Convention Center on February 13th, along with Deborah Hughes from the Museum and House. Thank you. Thanks for taking the time.
Great to be here.
SusanB.org, if you want to get online, learn more, get tickets if you like. Rob Braden is the engineer of Connections. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful weekend wherever you are as we warm up, and we'll talk to you Monday on member-supported public radio.